There's a lot of that.
Yeah.
Where you know, we got the photos, or people are referred to by last name.
Yes.
Or first name.
Yeah.
And like when you get to all the Chinese, you know, oftentimes, like on one of the documents that I sent you,
yeah,
there's just a Chinese signature. It's not typed out who it is.
Yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't say, so what are they?
Right.
Who do they represent?
Right.
But, you know, you make do with what you have.
Well, I may be able to put you in touch with one of the people who would have been a young man at the time, about my same age then.
Mm-hmm.
So he would have been 30 years old, something
mm-hmm.
like that. Who was helping run the Chinese delegation.
Mm.
He might be able to identify those people. He's living here in the United States now.
Okay.
He actually applied for asylum several years after the first blush of Fujian, Oregon's sister state province.
So did he apply like after Tiananmen? Because that would be 5 years after.
I think it was before Tiananmen. He was a part of the first exchange program.
Yeah.
He was at PSU. His name is Huang Jiehua.
Mm-hmm.
And he now calls himself Alan Huang, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I have his address and contact information. He lives down in the Los Angeles
area. That'd be great.
Good man.
Yeah.
Really good man. But he
yeah.
have a very interesting perspective on
yeah.
that from the
yeah.
Chinese side.
Exactly.
Very valuable.
I've been looking up, for instance, some of the government people. So, the main Fujian guy was Hu.
Yeah,
and he's not really listed.
Yeah.
So
Well,
it's like if you go to their stuff, they list here's this ex governor doing this and this ex governor doing this, and his is one of those brief things that says that he might have taken a bad political step in the intervening 30 years or
right,
something.
It's certainly quite possible.
Yeah.
That's maybe why it's interesting if you want to talk to Jiehua.
Yeah,
he's a really good man.
Yeah,
and would have a very straightforward and very clear-eyed perspective on what was happening with
yeah.
the Chinese at that time.
Yeah,
we formed our own perception here, you know, for better or worse, as we went through it.
Right. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating, and it's so interesting to find out. You know, we know Vic as the guy who was doing 20 trade missions and
right.
all this stuff. But finding out, he was the first governor to do it in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time 84-ish,
yeah.
he was beginning to bump into the Bill Clintons of the world.
Right.
Who were saying, hey, everywhere I go, you've been already several times.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think we crossed paths with several other state delegations in Tokyo at the
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
But that was a remarkable trip for several different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the Chinese part of it was only half of it. The
Japanese yeah, exactly.
part of it was the more triumphal part.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese part came about on the heels of the unitary tax
right.
Rearrangements. So
yeah.
that the Japanese investors who wanted to bring semiconductor facilities and others into the United States were looking for a kind of a tax structure that allowed them to invest in ways that made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And ATIA and the Oregon legislature had actually been quite responsive to that.
Mm-hmm.
So ATIA had pulled together a one-day session of the legislature to repeal the unitary tax or whatever it was at the time. And the consequence was that the Japanese industrial sector felt respected.
Mm-hmm.
It was fundamentally about that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so much about the economics. The economics mattered, of course.
Yeah.
But what they felt was respected and listened to.
Yeah.
And the consequence was that when we got to Tokyo, the delegation was treated quite royally.
Mm-hmm.
I have no reason to think that we were the only delegation ever treated royally.
Right.
But they made it feel that way.
Yeah.
And I do believe that we were the first state delegation that was ever invited to address the Keidanren, the industrial coalition
right.
at the top of the Japanese management of their
yeah.
Of their economy. And it was also around the time that Cho DiZono had pulled together the From Oregon with Love show,
exactly
right
yeah
and is Ono is highly respected in Japan, and of course his father-in-law, George Asamano, has been the recipient of advanced awards from the government of Japan, the emperor, and so on. So that didn't hurt.
Yeah.
But it meant that the delegation was truly welcomed, and that there were doors open a lot of different places in Japan. And the sort of piggybacking of the second half of the trip over to China involved a shift of personnel. Some people came in the China half and didn't come in the Japanese half, and vice versa. I wound up going on both halves of that trip, having spent a lot of time doing Portland, China sister city work before then, and some work on the Oregon Fujian sister state stuff,
but
mostly on the sister city stuff.
Yeah.
My practice at the time was international law. I was a young lawyer with a lot of ambition. that may be redundant. and my goal was to build an international trade practice in Oregon.
Yeah.
And it was an unusual goal at the time because the perception was, well, there was a lot of commerce flowing through Oregon. The actual contractual work was done somewhere else. It was done in San Francisco or Washington, D.C. or New York or somewhere else. Never made any sense to me why that should be so, and I wound up jumping into it in this way. China had only just been opened, of course. It was coming out of the 70s, and you'd started with ping-pong diplomacy with Nixon and wound up with formal recognition of the People's Republic of China under Carter, leading to a sort of a rediscovery of the awareness and historical almost love affair between America and China.
Yeah.
Goes back. And, of course, there was a lot of hope at the time and a lot of probably blinderedness on both the Chinese and the American sides about who they really were and so on.
I think we're going to be seeing the same thing with Cuba in the next couple of years.
I expect we probably will. But all of that's probably necessary for a process of rediscovery, and it was fine.
Yeah.
Victor Atiyah had lived through a lot of that history. So he'd been alive, you know, when the Chinese Communist Revolution had happened. He remembered the fall of the Republic of China government on the mainland and the exile to Taiwan. He'd been very politically aware of that transition and the difficulty of it, and he was not unaware of the pain and suffering on the mainland under Mao's regime and the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution and all the rest of that. I think that politically he was uncomfortable with the entire affair, which made the sequence of events kind of interesting because he also knew that he was the governor of Oregon and not the Secretary of State of the United States.
Yeah.
And he was very careful in all of these dealings to know what his role was and was not. So he wanted to make a statement about his own and, in his view, Oregon's respect for the free market system and the politics of a more open side of China, as he understood it. At the same time, he knew that he could only do so much of that.
Right.
And one of the legislators in the 1984 legislature was Mei Yi.
Right.
So Mei Yi
was along on this trip.
Yeah, it was along on the trip. Well, Mei Yi was represented Albany and Steve Yi's longtime wife, and her family had come from Fujian province. And Mei was kind of a remarkable figure in her own right. A very unusual thought that, you know, a Chinese lady would wind up representing the Albany district in the Oregon Senate. But she led a push rooted in that sort of blush of hope and confidence to pass a resolution of the Oregon legislature that Oregon and Fujian should be sister state provinces.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that resolution was one that the governor couldn't very well veto. Mm-hmm. It wasn't his preference, though, would have been that Oregon was a sister state province with Taiwan.
Right.
And so what he did was, by executive order, declare that that's what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so the fascinating thing about that October delegation to Fujian is that it succeeded a June 84 delegation that Atiyah led to Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
And the you perhaps have already gathered the story of that trip. I was not on it, so mm-hmm. my understanding of it is secondhand. But I understand that what Atiyah wanted to do was, in his own sort of quiet, non-confrontational way, establish that the acceptance of the Fujian relationship, which he intended to do,
mm-hmm.
was not a rejection of a historical relationship
yeah.
with Taiwan.
Yeah.
Very important to him. Part of his sort of sense of personal loyalty and standing for the things that mattered
mm-hmm.
long term. And so his delegation to Taiwan was about that. It was
mm-hmm.
very important to the Taiwanese
mm-hmm.
that, and well, to the Republic of China officials on Taiwan
right.
in particular. Right.
Right.
Atiyah very carefully supervised the negotiation of the sister state protocol
mm-hmm.
And took guidance from the Department of State about that in such
mm-hmm.
a way that the offending language with respect to the Shanghai communique, that is to say,
mm-hmm.
we could deal with Taiwan all we wanted, but we were not allowed to call it the Republic of China anymore, right?
Right?
So that the sister province protocol with Taiwan was not, it did not contain those offending words.
Yeah.
My understanding, and again, I was not there, so
mm-hmm.
check this with people who were. Doug Frengel might be a good source.
Mm-hmm.
I think he might have been there at the time. Dave Luchin, if you can track
him.
Oh,
yeah, he's definitely on my list.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Is that at the banquet for signing,
mm-hmm.
With all of the cameras flashing and the lights flashing and beaming it around and so on and so on, Atiyah was presented with a version of the protocol that had one small change. And that was that Taiwan was identified as Taiwan Republic of China,
mm-hmm.
right? Not just Taiwan China or
mm-hmm.
Taiwan, and certainly not Taiwan People's Republic of China,
mm-hmm.
but just Taiwan Republic of China.
Mm-hmm.
And Atiyah, under the lights and under the cameras, said, ah, there's one small change. We'll just have to defer. I'll sign it privately tomorrow, but let's drink toast to each other about this.
Mm-hmm.
He refused to sign it
mm-hmm.
with that language in it. Well, that language has enormous symbolic importance.
Yeah.
It's why the folks on Taiwan put it back in.
Yeah.
Right? It has enormous symbolic importance on the other side of the Taiwan Straits, which is why the People's Republic of China noticed what
mm-hmm.
Atiyah had done.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I believe that one of the reasons we were treated so royally when we got to Fujian was that we'd become our delegation, and certainly Atiyah's just being who he was,
mm-hmm.
had become a bit of an important move
mm-hmm.
in the game between Taiwan and China at
mm-hmm.
the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was just fascinating to watch. So when we got to Beijing, the plane landed at the old Beijing airport. Nobody
mm-hmm.
would even conceive that just 30 years ago it looked like that.
Yeah.
We drove into Tiananmen Square on two-lane roads where
mm-hmm.
we were, you know, moving around, Warren Buffalo and,
right.
you know,
yeah.
so on, and it, where there's now a multi-lane superhighway.
Right? Mm-hmm.
We were one of very few cars in the entire city
mm-hmm.
where now it's one of the most choked
yeah.
automobile-filled cities on the planet. Bicycles everywhere. You don't see that many bicycles
mm-hmm.
in Beijing anymore. And everybody was wearing the gray suits.
Mm-hmm.
That was just the garb.
Yeah.
We were staying in the old section of the Beijing Hotel,
mm-hmm.
and we were treated beautifully
mm-hmm.
by everybody. We were kept fairly isolated in
mm-hmm.
some sense. We were allowed to, you know, shop at particular places near Tiananmen Square. But at the same time, we were being interviewed by the very senior leadership mm-hmm. in the government of China. And mm-hmm. one of the highlights of the trip was going to what I think is called the Room of Purple Lights.
Mm-hmm.
And it is one of the most beautiful rooms I've ever been in my life, where Atiyeh and Zhao Ziyang, mm-hmm. then the premier of China, if mm-hmm. I remember, if I have the title right, mm-hmm. held an audience back and forth.
Yeah.
I was, you know, one of the most junior members of the delegation and was sort of behind a pillar watching the thing. But we were all there. And watching that interchange and Atiyeh's just basic steadiness, holding his own and saying the sort of yeah. platitudes you say in that sort of a setting back and forth, knowing that in some sense he was being a pawn in a game bigger than himself,
yeah.
knowing that his job was just to be who he was,
yeah.
right? That the consequences of this he couldn't entirely control,
right?
But the way he played it were in his control. It was really a very powerful performance. He was never shaken. He was never troubled by it. He just knew his job was to be who he was through and through. And he did a beautiful job with it, I thought.
Uh-huh.
There were various tours and whatnot, and I didn't go on all of them.
Right.
I would have exhausted anybody to do. After touring different businesses in Beijing and so on, and the whole delegation flew down to Fujian, mm-hmm. to Fuzhou, and I think some of the photos in your archive, by the way, are of initial receptions. The one with the orange chairs, for some reason, I think may be in the very first let's all sit together and have a cup of tea reception when we got to the Beijing airport.
Okay.
We got off the plane and all of our luggage was independently checked and no doubt searched and so on and collected independently, and it seemed to take hours to mm-hmm. get us from the plane into transport into the central city. And but every time something like that happened, there was some formal
yeah.
thing going on that you could
yeah.
you could connect up to. And when we got to Fujian, we were taken to I think it was called West Lake Village or Westlake Resort or something mm-hmm. like that. They wouldn't call it a resort, but it was essentially a conference center and, mm-hmm. and probably a safe place you could put foreign dignitaries
yeah.
where they didn't interfere too much with what was going on. We weren't kept locked up there by any means.
Mm-hmm.
So Sam Anderson and I used to go out jogging in the morning and we'd run down the local streets and we got these delighted, incredulous stares from
yeah.
Chinese who clearly were as surprised as we were to find ourselves, you know, in their midst. And they were very friendly and just delightful people. And obviously mm-hmm. we didn't speak very much Chinese and mm-hmm. we didn't speak very much English, but you could see from how they were reacting that what was going on was momentous.
Mm-hmm.
Not because we were Oregon or anything like that, but just because we were there.
Yeah.
We were foreigners jogging through their neighborhoods thinking this was a routine thing.
Yeah.
And it was like, whoa, the world has just changed. I don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
But you could feel it being a lightness in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that was fun. We obviously did a lot of the industrial tours and those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
In Fujian,
mm-hmm.
we sat down mostly then to negotiate the sister state city protocol.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that the Fujian delegation was particularly interested in reaching industrial agreement on something that they called radio pre-process equipment. That means semiconductors.
Yeah.
Okay. And what they really would have liked would have been to acquire an operating semiconductor plant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was probably not in the cards.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't, I think, have any Intel executives along on the trip. We mm-hmm. had CH2M Hill executives mm-hmm. who were in the business of building semiconductor plants mm-hmm. for different people around the world, so they certainly understood something of that side of things. I think we had Nike folks. We certainly had a lot of Portland people.
Mm-hmm.
Blake Herring was mm-hmm. Was a sort of a co-leader of the delegation from
yeah.
the Port of Portland side. We had a lot of lumber folks. Alan mm-hmm. Struthers is in your mm-hmm. archive, marvelous man. we had, obviously Vic's son was along and was doing some sort of trading in the family business. And, then reporters and whatnot. It was a pretty fascinating group, and then some of us hanging around trying to figure out what the heck was going on and where it was going.
Right.
But in the course of these negotiations, what became fairly apparent was that Governor Hu Ping had the authority as the head of Fujian province to direct what would happen in the industrial sector, as you would expect in a state-controlled economy. What also became apparent was that our Chinese counterparts understood us to be a polity comparable to Fujian, which meant that their going-in assumption about us was that, A, we had the same sort of mass that Fujian had. So Fujian is a province of tens of millions of people. Right? The concept that Oregon was really only 3 million people hadn't really entered their consciousness.
Yeah.
They can see us on a map. It's big.
Yeah,
big
exactly.
Place. They know America's a big
country. One of the news stories actually has a picture of the maps.
Right.
It's like, look, they're comparable size.
Right.
And
comparable mountains. These
look
like,
at that. It's neat.
It's neat.
Yeah.
It's those sorts of things. But the comparative size, when it really sunk in, that actually by comparison with them, we were tiny. That was an interesting moment. The second interesting moment was when they finally confronted what we were saying to them. That, no, Governor Attia doesn't actually have the authority to tell Intel that they must deal with you with respect to radio pre-process equipment, right? Nor anyone else. That's not how we work, right? It's a we're delighted to set up exchanges at the university level and some of those kinds of things we can help do. And for that, you'll want to deal with this person who's associated with that institution. Governor Attia can exercise a lot of sort of moral and bully pulpit leadership, but doesn't have the capacity to order anybody in the state what to do, except those who report to him directly in the governor's office. And then
and
he has
both
he
of them are here doing what he wants.
Both of them are here doing what he wants. Denny Miles and and actually the staff of what was then the International Trade Division of the, of the Oregon Economic Development Department.
Yeah.
Those were, I guess, formally directly directly on the governor's staff. So it was their sort of dawning realization that this amazing event had taken place and that they weren't dealing with people who could deliver what they thought they could deliver. It was a very interesting set of occurrences. We ultimately did get these protocols negotiated. I think they are now framed and hanging on the wall at Business Oregon over at the World Trade Center. I've been told that the last couple of days as I was trying to track them down.
Yeah.
And somebody sent me a nice faxed copy of them. So
I sent you the thing from the archives.
Yeah, thank you.
And the pages are out of order.
Yeah.
As I divided them up, I said, nine should go with 10.
Right.
Yeah.
So then we had this fascinating thing because we'd sort of drafted these things back and forth, and of course they needed to be formalized for signature. And Chinese formalization involved the creation of the Chinese character version of it, and the English formalization involved somebody needing to type it. So this was the Bill story, my primary contribution to this whole exercise. People may or may not have thought I was at all useful in some of the negotiations, but at the end of the day, there was a typewriter. It was a monster old manual typewriter where they got it. But it had an English keyboard. There was paper, and they needed someone who could type it. Well, I said, well, I can muddle through. I know how to type. I've always typed my term papers kind of thing.
Right.
So I actually typed the signature version of the protocol on the English side. And I remember that we were all going to get ready to go down for the banquet. And and I finished up half an hour before that or something and said, here it is. And they said, but we need two copies. And I said, surely you have a copy machine, right? Well, let me make some calls. So they call around. Well, it turns out there is one copy machine. This is 1984, right? There is one copy machine in Fuzhou, the capital of Fujian province. And it is all the way across town at Fuzhou University, and it is locked and inaccessible unless you have the right security clearance.
Yeah.
Which tells you something about where China had just come from.
Right.
Now,
right.
Today, obviously, there's copy machines in every corner in China. Yeah. That kind of information control doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And it's hard to understand how recently that was the consciousness of China.
Yeah.
But this story may help illustrate it, that at that moment, the only way to get the second signature copy was for me to type it again,
mm-hmm.
which I did. And mm-hmm. as a consequence, I missed the signing banquet
mm-hmm.
because I was busy typing the second copy, which is fine. You know, it's a there are a lot of those banquets, and you can only eat so many sea
right.
slugs before you're really done. That is.
Talking to Vic about those banquets was actually hilarious.
Oh, I can imagine.
He's a meat and potatoes guy.
Oh, absolutely.
In fact, his wife was always frustrated because she's adventurous, and he just won't eat it.
Well, so
but he, you know, he just stuck to his guns. He didn't drink much. He didn't.
No, he absolutely didn't. But I'll tell you another story about Vic Atiyah drinking, right? Because, of course, both in Japan and in China,
mm-hmm.
you're supposed to drink these kanpai toasts,
yeah.
or I forget what the Chinese phrase is off the top of my head. I should remember, ganbei or something. And they always give you this horrible fiery liquid,
yeah.
And you're always suspecting that they're actually drinking water because it's always just a clear thing out of a shot glass, and you have these sort of almost Russian, you
yeah.
know, knock it back contests and toasts, and so I actually in that year had not been drinking at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'd sworn off having anything to drink from just as an experiment in my own life from January mm-hmm. 1st on. And that lasted through about the first 7 days of the trip in Japan
mm-hmm.
when Doug Fringel had brought us to a fish house in Tokyo run by the Ogashi Fish House, run by a lady who was opening a similar fish house
yeah.
here in Northwest Portland. And she subsequently did. It was a delicious
mm-hmm.
place and so on. And they treated us like long-lost family, which means that they gave us all of the greatest delicacies
mm-hmm.
of the Chinese cuisine of the sea, Japanese cuisine
mm-hmm.
of the sea, which means it was all stuff that we would throw away. Right?
Lots of bait.
A lot of bait. It was just, you couldn't not eat it.
Yeah.
Because you were being honored.
Yeah.
At the same time, I just thought it would probably go down better if I had some of that sake. So
exactly. Let me kill off some of the bacteria.
I thought, you know, 9 months, that's pretty good. I guess that demonstrates that this
and
one's all right.
For an international cause? It's a higher
international cause, it was fine.
Exactly.
So I had been sort of a companion with Governor Atiyah in my own quiet way about this, not
yeah.
necessarily participating
yeah.
in these toasts until that moment. And then after that, I realized that my principle had been violated, so I probably couldn't get away with that much more. So
mm-hmm.
I was also young
mm-hmm.
and kind of an enthusiast
mm-hmm.
on the trip and had, leapt in with great enthusiasm, probably ahead of my station
mm-hmm.
a time or two when I
mm-hmm.
Perhaps should not have. And Atiyah was very understanding about all of that. He
mm-hmm.
was a gracious man. And I was, I hope, sensitive enough to understand that after the first time or two when I'd done it, that that was not my place without him having to sort of formally discipline me in any way.
Yeah.
And backed off from it. Nonetheless, he became aware that my role in doing things like typing the things up was useful to
mm-hmm.
the delegation, and I was always
mm-hmm.
willing to sort of pick up those kinds of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And when we flew out of Fujian,
mm-hmm.
We flew through, stopped in Guangzhou.
Mm-hmm.
We had a brief sort of trade luncheon with some folks in Guangzhou.
Yeah.
And then took the hop over into Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Entering Hong Kong was a psychologically fascinating experience
mm-hmm.
because we had just come from the experience of landing in Beijing and being the only airplane on the tarmac
yeah.
and coming through a sort of a customs reception process that took an hour and a half and it involved us needing to meet with all all sorts of high officials and having every move being constrained by a lot of people around us and mm-hmm. protecting us and keeping us from too much contact with the locals in case mm-hmm. the pollution should go either way. You know, mm-hmm. same kind of experience in Fuzhou. Mm-hmm. Graciously hosted, no question, but very closely controlled set of interactions. Yeah. With everything being frugal,
mm-hmm.
it's very frugal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so yes, it was gracious. So there was a table of fruit, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like you could go down to the corner and buy something at the shop,
right?
Right. It was
right.
So we when we left Fuzhou, went out through Guangzhou and into Hong Kong. Landing in Hong Kong, stepping off the plane,
mm-hmm.
Which was a CAAC flight,
mm-hmm.
And stepping into effectively the modern world
mm-hmm.
was a truly remarkable experience. Because we walked into the customs area, and what we saw was, in place of the sort of one booth through which we'd all come in Beijing,
yeah.
major capital of one of the major countries on
yeah.
Earth, one booth, we saw 25 or 30 booths.
Mm-hmm.
And as our delegation walked off the plane towards those booths, we saw the Hong Kong customs officials lining up to fill them, the lights coming on, all of us flowing through. It took about 4 minutes
mm-hmm.
to process the entire plane load of us through into Hong Kong. And the most miraculous and amazing thing about it was that openness, that directness, that competence, that flow through, that
mm-hmm.
immediacy, that just get things done quality had nothing to do with our official status.
Yeah.
It had everything to do with that's just how it can
yeah.
be done. That's how a society that actually is focused on getting things done and openness and not worrying
yeah.
about all the rest of it.
Their whole reason for being there is to connect to the world.
So
yeah.
we wound up staying at on the Kowloon side
mm-hmm.
under the bay at,
mm-hmm.
at a big, beautiful hotel, Regency or something,
mm-hmm.
Where I've stayed a time or two since. It's just a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a final delegation banquet,
mm-hmm.
all of us. So this was just the Oregon people.
Yeah.
Right? And at that banquet, Governor Tia finally broke his vow of abstinence. And he came around and he tapped me on the shoulder and he had a glass of some of that horrible Chinese,
mm-hmm.
you know, fire water. And he said, "Time to toast." I stood up. And he downed it, and then he went around and did it with three or four other people. And the only discernible effect of all of his alcohol flowing through the Atiyah constitution was that his ears got redder.
Yeah.
You know, was it was really very gracious and letting his hair down
yeah.
a bit.
Yeah.
But it was really a remarkable, a remarkable tour.
Yeah. Fascinating. So how do you get to be part of a delegation? Did you, as a young lawyer, get contacted by the development people, or did you hear about it and say, "Ooh, that's what I do"? Or
I had heard that they were planning it,
mm-hmm.
and so you could apply to be a part of it. I had been very active in the sister state province
right.
stuff, and I'd been very
right.
active in pulling together the Oregon China. I forget what we called it. It was a business association,
mm-hmm.
a business with China. I'd been
mm-hmm.
studying Chinese. I'd been working on Chinese legal things and
mm-hmm.
writing some articles and so on. So at the time, there wasn't anyone in the United States who knew anything about Chinese law.
Mm-hmm.
That's not quite true. There were maybe one or two people. There was somebody at a
mm-hmm.
firm in Washington, D.C., and somebody at a firm in San Francisco. But when you looked into it, what you also realized was, at the time, there was no Chinese law.
Right.
Literally, no. Chinese law. It
yeah.
was all what the Communist Party wanted to
yeah.
do. So one of the things that was going on was China was busy writing laws.
Mm-hmm.
They were writing their joint venture statute and their this, that, and the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you could kind of keep up with the development of Chinese commercial law in those early days. Mm-hmm. It's very, very interesting. So I was in the process of doing that, which meant that I was actually a genuine expert in Chinese law, because Chinese law was only as big as a teacup, right?
Yeah.
You could do that if you set your mind to it. Partly as a consequence of that trip, I became aware that it was going to be a long time before my fascination with China and Chinese trade was going to be able to turn into a practice that could actually support a family. And I wound up doing much more work on the Japanese side with some of the contacts we put together there. And we wound up opening an office in Tokyo as a consequence of that. And that's a whole different set of stories.
Mm-hmm.
But the formation of the delegation to go to China was something that I thought that I was probably sufficiently proven.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd worked enough with the International Trade Division that they kind of knew who I was a bit, that it was logical for me to suggest that maybe this would be a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
What I remember is that I asked to be a member of the delegation to China, and it was Dave Luchin or Doug Frengel, one of those guys, who sent me a note saying, congratulations, you've been accepted as a member of the delegation to Japan.
There you go.
And I wrote back and said, well, that's kind of nice, but it was China I was interested in going to.
Uh-huh.
And it took a little longer, and they plugged me into that.
Yeah.
I think that for the purposes of the delegation to Japan at the time, what was needed was a large enough delegation to constitute mass.
Right.
Right. That was part of the respect for the Japanese that we needed to show, was to bring enough people that we could be talking about, just visually almost, just as a matter of human mass, opening a big pipe to this Japanese industry, that we were connecting up with enough of that. So part of that was just, you know, having enough bodies. I was a sufficiently qualified body that I was unlikely to embarrass anyone. And in fact, of course, I didn't embarrass anybody. But I think that was about a 30-person delegation, if I remember, something on that order. And there was a lot of advanced work that was done by the guys to make sure all that went off very, very well. And, and it was done, you know, quite nicely. The Chinese side was a little more complicated, because there was this trade back and forth of, we'll pick up your expenses once you're in China, and then it's how much people is that and how many is it, and some of those kinds of things, and you pick up your hotel, but you don't pick up this other piece. And so the size of the delegation was limited, and they ultimately wound up realizing they had a spot that I could fit into. And actually there were two of us out of the legal profession on that, Sam Anderson and I. Actually, I'm trying to remember whether what was his name? There was a fellow who'd been head of the Japan American Society and so on, who was on the Japanese side, but I don't think he came on the Chinese side, if I remember right. Anyway, that's more or less how I got to be a part of that.
Yeah. When you're on one of these and you're looking at, you know, especially that big Japan delegation, but then it's also, you see this with the Chinese one, is it lean and mean? Everybody's there because there's some business connection, or are there political hangers-on who are part of it? I'm thinking, you know, Blake Herring, who could play both of those roles.
Well, Blake was,
but he's the president of the port.
Port of Portland. So he was pursuing Port of Portland.
Yeah,
he was focused on his job as that.
Yeah,
there were a couple of reporters. There were a lot of people who were just figuring things out. People were there to see what business could be done. There were a couple of business meetings that I'd lined up ahead of time to see if it was possible to do some things in China. I took a side trip up to Xi'an, where the warriors are, and so on, to talk to some people.
Yeah.
But I think that while there was some advance work done in the hope that you could develop some business, the real purpose of being there was to see if you could make connections that would establish business
right.
over the period. That was the excuse you gave yourself for spending your company's money to go have just an amazing experience anyway.
Yeah.
And I think that you know people were doing that. So mm-hmm. our friends from CH2M Hill were certainly looking at the opportunity to do the modernization of Chinese infrastructure, mm-hmm. which is something that would have been superb at civil engineers, mm-hmm. right? And I imagine that they probably picked up some of that along the way and at the very least learned a lot about
yeah.
What the real needs were and how they needed to think about it.
Yeah.
So it's not so much I want to make a deal mm-hmm. as the potential for deals here is vast. Mm-hmm. I need to understand a little more about how this place works.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come away from it with some direct human contacts. Mm-hmm. Deals are always made between, you know, one human being and another human being. They're not mm-hmm. made between organizations at all.
Right.
So those direct human contacts become really important.
Yeah.
So
did you get a sense, I mean, you were talking about the realization of the Chinese that Oregon doesn't have anybody living in it. did you get a sense that from the Chinese side, this was the same kind of thing, or was it more diplomatic than economic? I mean, what was your sense?
I think that... I think the Chinese expected it to be more economic more quickly.
Okay.
That would be my sense. They were pushing for that.
Okay, yeah.
What deal can we buy some of this? Can we?
Yeah.
And actually, there were some structural deals entered into to buy, like, advanced sawmill equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Struthers brokered a deal
right.
like that he put together. And ultimately, there were connections made that allowed them to get into some not on the restricted list semiconductor processing.
Yeah.
So it actually yeah. did lead to things.
Yeah. Right?
It wasn't foolish in mm-hmm. that regard that they should think that. But I think they were very focused on the expectation that business would come out of it.
Okay.
There was a reciprocal delegation, which of course you've also studied mm-hmm. Hu Ping coming back,
yeah.
which was fascinating in its own way. Les Wearson from CH2M Hill chaired the host committee.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing we did was to put together a budget to host a like number of people from Fujian coming over here.
Mm-hmm.
And then we doubled it. And we had to go raise that money because it wasn't like government mm-hmm. had a slush fund of
right.
state money that could be used for such things. So everybody contributed. And it was a $40,000 or $60,000 budget or something. And then I remember that they reminded us that they had hosted us from touchdown in Beijing to takeoff in Guangzhou,
mm-hmm.
right? And that they expected to be hosted in the same way in the United States. And we were fine with that.
Mm-hmm.
We were going to land in San Francisco. We were going to tour them around San Francisco a little mm-hmm. bit and then bring them up to Portland. They said, well, what about that trip to Disneyland? So, as I remember, we had to arrange for Governor Hu Ping and his troop to go to Disneyland.
Uh-huh.
I didn't participate
in that yeah.
part of the trip. But we set up a pretty good tour for them mm-hmm. right here.
Mm-hmm.
Industrially, by comparison with what China was looking like at the time,
mm-hmm.
Oregon holds its own
yeah.
against Fujian province, no question about it. That was an interesting exchange back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
They realized that. It was sort of the reciprocal of suddenly realizing that Oregon has very few people in it,
mm-hmm.
is getting here and realizing that maybe very few people, but there's an amazing industrial economy
right.
here. We don't think of that as Oregonians. We're aware of our relatively small population
right.
status by comparison with the countries of Asia where there are so many people
yeah.
That are organized in a much more rural economy. The density of the industrial capacity, even of Oregon, which is a fairly agricultural and
mm-hmm.
Natural resources state, is really quite astounding.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
they were seeing that.
One of the things that I'm really looking at and seeing how it worked, Vic saw cleaning up the land use to international trade as part of a single, seamless economic development.
Yes.
And the what you just said is fits in with the land use
yeah.
arguments from the early 70s on.
Oh, absolutely.
That he was implementing and getting people to clean up and
yeah, absolutely.
That kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we tend to forget that in the 70s and flowing into the 80s, the commonality between the political parties of those goals Bulls mm-hmm. was pretty strong.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
you're talking about the era of Tom McCall and Mark Hatfield as
yeah.
state officials, and Clay Myers and Picatee was very much a part of that.
Yeah.
So, at the time in the Oregon political process, when Clay and Vic were running against each other for the Republican nomination, mm-hmm. it must have been the
1974. Yeah.
For governor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He knocks off Clay then, and he knocks off McCall in 1978.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Did Clay run again in 1978?
No. That was Roger Martin and Tom
okay.
McCall.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
but Clay right. continued to be Secretary of State.
Yes.
So,
if Atiyah was governor in 1984, as obviously he was.
He was elected in 1978. He'd been reelected in 1982,
right.
beating Kulongoski.
Right.
So
that's right. That's
yeah.
right. Right. So
and his international stuff, he'd done some. I think
so
as far as I can tell, 6 trips. But then he does 14 of them in his second term.
So wasn't it 1978 when he knocked off Clay in the Republican gubernatorial primary?
No, that's 1974.
Oh, 74. I see. Okay.
Yeah.
And then, oh, I see. Of course.
Yeah.
And then he lost to.
He lost to Straub.
To Straub in that election.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember talking with Clay years ago
mm-hmm.
about Vic, and he said, you know, at the time. People saw me, Clay,
mm-hmm.
as the sort of progressive Republican in,
mm-hmm.
in the Wayne Morse mold and all that sort of thing, and Vic as the highly conservative,
yeah.
you know. And he said, I never saw the man that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I worked for him after he beat me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He saw him as quieter. But he saw him as just a fundamental man of principle. He was a great admirer of
yeah.
Vic Atiyah's and
yeah.
somebody considered a friend.
Yeah.
So, a complex guy.
Yeah, yeah. It's going back and looking at it, and Atiyah did in the early 90s, he did an oral history with the Oregon Historical Society.
Mm-hmm.
65 tapes, thousands of pages. I've got every single one of them here. It's given me the framework for the book.
Yeah.
He was... In the early 90s, at times it seemed bitter that the media kept calling him in 74 or 78 again the conservative candidate.
Yeah.
And I was talking with Ted Kulongoski
yeah.
Last week and talking about that because Ted lost to Vic by the biggest number
yes.
up to that point. Ted is so happy Bill Sizemore ran in 98 because Ted says, when you're second place in politics, no one pays any attention anymore.
That's right.
But... Ted was, from his point of view, and it's my memory as well, it wasn't that Atiyah was conservative, it's that the McCalls and the Packwoods, these were truly liberals.
Yeah.
Well, they were true liberals, social or fiscal conservatives, but truly liberals to the left of Democrats on a number of issues.
Oh, no question.
And
no
then
question.
Jake was more in the middle, and that's where he stayed forever.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's a good characterization. And
yeah.
I think that if we look at the labels applied at the time
mm-hmm.
through the lens of today's politics, we will completely misunderstand Vic Atiyah.
Yeah.
The same thing's true of other politicians.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, I've heard it said that, you know, Nixon was the last liberal president. There's a lot of truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the EPA and some other kinds
mm-hmm.
of things that came out. Well, at the time, no one who voted in the Democratic primary could see Nixon as anything other than
right.
you know, the scourge of the right wing and all those sort of things. But politics have really moved,
yeah.
and they've shifted rightward in general.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pity because the pragmatic politics of accomplishment at the center of the Democratic and Republican parties did a lot of good for the state for many decades.
Yeah.
And Vic was absolutely a part of that whole thing.
Yeah, in Oregon, it's kind of settled in. It's like the county commissioners because they have to actually pave a road.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it doesn't matter what party they are. They have got to pave the road.
Right.
But when you get above that, it
just
splits over. Yeah.
Of course, in any election, polarization is what has to happen so that you get people excited enough to go vote.
Oh, exactly.
So
yeah,
in any election, it gets described in apocalyptic terms.
Exactly.
My perception is it actually is more apocalyptic now than it was, but perhaps not.
Well, you know, even Bob Straub, Thin Skin, apparently. money never really forgave Vic for the 78 election.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. And Ted Kulongoski and Vic never really dealt with each other until Ted became governor. Huh. And then he'd get on the phone and call him. And they ended up, for the last 10 years of Vic's life, Vic just treasured his relationship with Ted.
So. I don't perceive that Vic has a bone in his body or had a bone in his body that's capable of harboring resentment
mm-hmm.
if someone was reaching out to him.
Yeah.
It's just not who the man was.
Yeah.
I understand why he would feel bitter, because it was like, don't they understand?
Yeah.
It's more like that. It
yeah.
wouldn't be, I'm angry at them and I'm going to, you know, it wouldn't be vindictive in any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, those who work closely with him talk about being able to go in a different direction and having arguments with him. And then you come in the next day and you just go back to work.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he just, that was that. We're done.
That's right.
We made a collective decision. Off we go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I obviously enjoyed the contact I had with him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. So anything else on these trade delegations? Did you do any others besides this one?
No, not with Vic. I think he did a couple others as they went along.
Yeah.
I wound up being on some boards and commissions for him. There's an Oregon China Commission or something
yeah.
like that I served on for a while.
Yeah.
I mentioned Alan Huang
mm-hmm.
earlier. So Huang Jiahua, Alan Huang,
mm-hmm.
and Ren, I forget what his full name was, were the two sort of primary managers and handlers of our delegation to
mm-hmm.
Fujian in Beijing, Fujian, and Guangzhou, and then the return delegation of Huping here.
Mm-hmm.
And they became the first Chinese exchange duo at PSU,
mm-hmm.
the exchange program.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of, and there were some family issues and some other kinds of things that made Alan very uneasy
yeah.
about the prospects of returning to China at the
yeah.
end of his stay. And I remember that the sort of blush of, you know, filled with hope and everything's
mm-hmm.
rosy period that I associate with all of that, not that there weren't threads earlier of unease
mm-hmm.
about how Mr. Ren was doing some things and so on, it sort of came to a formal bright line, and it's something I always respected
mm-hmm.
Vic for in his own just straightforward way.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that he put up a brick wall he wanted people to run into, he just didn't move on some
yeah.
things. And one of them was Huang Jiahua decided he really couldn't go back.
Mm-hmm.
It was risky for him to go back to China at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Huping, looking at this whole relationship, basically said, your job is to put that boy on a plane and get him home.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And Atiya said, you know, that's not really how we do things
yeah.
here. And that probably created some strain.
Mm-hmm.
That and led to at least an extended period of time in which things didn't happen quite so,
mm-hmm.
You know, whatever you could follow up on.
Mm-hmm.
But it, no doubt someone else might have found a way to put all kinds of pressure and make life miserable in such a way that that Huang Jiahua would have had to get on a plane.
Yeah.
Atiya did nothing of the sort.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of a part of who he was.
Yeah.
No. The price of whatever it is you think we're buying cannot be that this young man gets turned into a slave. He gets
yeah.
to make his own choice.
Yeah.
I may approve or not approve his choice, but it's not up to me.
Right.
My authority is in this frame, and I can exercise that authority, but it
mm-hmm.
doesn't include telling this young man that he has to get back on the plane.
Yeah.
Whether he's making a good choice or a bad choice, I
mm-hmm.
don't judge.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just telling you that it's not my job
mm-hmm.
to do that for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's not who I am. And I always respected it.
Mm-hmm.
It had an odd echo somewhat later when Huang Jiahua was applying for asylum. And there's there's an ongoing investigation that has to happen because right. obviously he'd been an official
yeah.
in this process, right? So if you are the FBI worrying about an assignment, one of the things you want to know is, who is this guy really?
Yeah.
And so I got interviewed about who this guy is really, and I hope may have helped that process a little bit. But then the asylum process itself is a decision by a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a court process in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was taking place in Los Angeles, if I remember mm-hmm. right. But Huang Jiahua asked me if I would write an affidavit for him
mm-hmm.
about this, because my persona as lawyer, he'd been consulting me a lot about this process. Mm-hmm. I didn't represent him in the asylum yeah. process itself. It was not an area I participated in. And that was a part of my decision about whether I wanted to pursue this business development with China or whether right. I had my own lines.
Yeah, absolutely.
Know? And I just realized that, you know, I couldn't ever buy my career on the back of, you know, a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote an affidavit mm-hmm. from the court that basically said, look, this is what really goes on and how it really is, and
mm-hmm.
we're all enthusiastic and great friends now and patting each other on the back and drinking toasts, but this is still real.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what impact my contribution had to mm-hmm. Huang Jiahua's asylum, but I quit thinking I had a major career in
yeah.
Fujian, Oregon
yeah.
trade or China-U.S. trade
yeah.
or, you know, representing Chinese interests in the United States as a lawyer or anything like that after that affidavit. I just didn't pursue it.
Yeah.
Because those guys are not stupid. They would yeah. know that I did that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So,
yeah. It's fascinating as you're saying that, because right about the same time, Vic makes his kind of triumphal trip back to Syria.
Yes.
And so there's lots of things going on. He talks to Assad.
Right.
You know, all these kinds of things. And he knows he's been briefed. He has a debriefing when he comes back with the State right. Department. He talked to the CIA, I mean, just all this kind of stuff.
Right.
But there were also the personal things.
Yes.
You know, there's the family things. I discovered, and this is, he told me to write Warts and All, which I told him is the only condition under which I would write this.
Yeah.
And his archive is the only archive I know of. It's completely open from day one. Mm-hmm. There are no restrictions whatsoever.
Wow.
But it turns out he was smuggling money in an interesting way, which may or may not have been illegal. There was a guy in Syria, a wealthy man in I think it was his hometown, it might have been in Damascus,
mm-hmm.
He said, I want you to go to the bazaar and I want you to buy anything you want, souvenirs, stuff you want, anything you want, it's, I'll pay for all of it. And the deal is, when you get back to the United States, you send the equivalent amount of money to his daughter, because the currency can't cross. And Vic, as Vic said, yeah, that's fine, we'll do that. But
I'll
be looking back and saying, okay, 1984 currency regulations, was he stepping over a line? I mean, it sounds to me kind of like blue jeans to the Soviet Union thing in the 70s. But
it's an interesting thing, and I'll put that in a little bit broader context.
Mm-hmm.
In that time period, much less than today,
mm-hmm.
There's still some places where it's true today, but in that time period particularly, there were a lot of places where you couldn't do currency exchange.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, some of them, you couldn't do currency exchange because of U.S. Treasury regulations, and
right.
Syria may have been one of those at the time.
Yeah.
Okay. So you couldn't send money in or get money out of those countries.
Yeah.
Okay. But many others were, like India,
mm-hmm.
where they controlled their own
right.
foreign exchange. And in those countries, it was not uncommon for a buyer of technology from the United States
mm-hmm.
who had permission to use foreign exchange to buy that technology with, to ask a U.S. supplier to over-invoice them
mm-hmm.
For the technology and mm-hmm. to provide them with a commission in the form of a deposit
mm-hmm.
to a bank in New York,
mm-hmm.
right? And what they were doing was getting currency out of the country,
yeah.
right? And if you, I don't think there was anything illegal in the United States about that, as long as you weren't dealing with a regime like Syria or
right.
something like that.
Right.
It was illegal. That sort of manipulation of the currency regulations was illegal in India.
For India, time, yes.
Example, right.
Yeah.
So, if you wanted to do that,
mm-hmm.
if you participated in that, what you had to recognize is you had to be really careful when you went to India.
Right.
Because it didn't matter in the United States. You can overpay for things and pay.
Yeah.
And if the guy wanted to be paid in New York as opposed to Bombay, it's fine. You can pay him wherever he wants to be paid.
Yeah.
That's just a
yeah.
commercial issue. It has nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
It has a lot to do with what's happening back in India.
Yeah.
So those sorts of arrangements were not uncommon on the fringes mm-hmm. of the commercial world.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating because I'll then look and see, did Atiyah Brothers do that with their imports? Because they were getting their import. Vic's uncle did
right.
some fascinating things. The rugs that we think of as Oriental rugs,
yeah.
it seems he basically invented. The bright colors, the patterns.
Uh-huh.
They're based on traditional stuff, but the American market wanted stuff.
Yep.
So he actually built a rug factory in Iran
oh,
in the 19-teens,
1920s. Oh, no kidding.
There.
I didn't
Maybe
I
even
didn't
before
that.
Then. But uh-huh. So that Iranian thing is going in some form until the revolution.
Yep.
And so they, you know, there's all sorts of stuff going on and it, sourcing their rugs. So I
don't know anything about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to his older brother again next week.
I think they would have been pretty careful about that.
Yeah,
what you're describing in the bazaar is Vic would have thought it was a family courtesy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, it's to him, it's totally a family thing.
Yeah.
It's a personal thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
he wouldn't
like,
bat an eye.
Yeah, and I very much doubt that, you know, anybody in the Treasury Department would give a
no.
rip about any of that. But
no.
it is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Effectively, you know, this is where it happens. And the boundary between family and official
yeah.
Can sometimes be a little fluid.
Yeah.
It's dangerous
yeah.
when you're a public official at that boundary to know how you have to do it. And sometimes
right.
it can be very destructive. I mean, we've obviously just watched this with
yeah.
Governor Kitzhaber and the
yeah.
former First Lady, right?
Yeah.
There was a complete breakdown of
yeah.
boundaries, and the missing voice in all of that is Governor Kitzhaber's knowing where the line needed to be.
Right.
And one doesn't
right.
have
the, not even where it legally is, but where it should
where it needed to be. Right.
Yeah.
And that's not. I don't. In all the mess that I've seen, I've just seen you know a very pushy person and someone who was very fond of her and not getting in her way. And
yeah.
wanting it all to work
yeah.
right, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything that's sort of genuinely malicious, but I have seen a lot that an objective person would say, no, you've got to draw the line here.
Yeah,
right.
And, yeah, and clearly we're finding out from the emails his staff was saying that fairly frequently.
His staff was trying to say that.
Yo!
yeah, so poor, you know, Chris
yeah.
Robin Hold, I see his name pop up and some of these kinds
yeah.
of things, and
yeah.
you just look at that and you just wonder if it would have been nice if they had a little more support from the government
yeah.
probably.
Yeah. In talking to older brother Ed last fall, when Atiyah was elected governor, Atiyah Brothers had no business with the state of Oregon.
Mm. Yeah.
Period. They just cut it off. I have no idea. I've got to figure out if they had any business before.
Yeah.
But they just said no. Well,
yeah.
he's governor. Nothing.
Well, that's how.
And
that's how you should do it.
Yeah.
It's hard sometimes because.
Yeah.
Yeah, there. If there was business before, you're sacrificing a source
yeah.
of revenue, but that's the right thing to do.
Yeah,
and it makes perfect sense to me that they
yeah.
would do that.
Yeah.
My my own family, my parents, when I was young, bought beautiful carpet from Atiyah Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And always
mm-hmm.
spoke highly of the firm and how they dealt. They just knew they could trust the guys.
Yeah,
and that's how everybody was.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So
I found out when Vic was governor, occasionally. Random guys, never women, random guys would come to the office. And his office door was basically open to anybody.
Yep.
And they'd ask to see the governor, and they were rug sales guys. And they'd come in, and Vic would invite them in, and they'd roll stuff out on the floor and look at thread counts and talk about sourcing.
Oh, nice.
It's like, jeez. That's so great.
It is great.
Yeah.
It's great. You know,
yeah.
And Oregon, I hope, is still small enough that that stuff can go on.
Yeah, yeah. Talking to Kulongoski, he was saying, you know, well, everybody since Vic starts out trying to be like Vic.
Yeah.
So you meet with your department heads once a week. You have an open door policy. But it's just there's just so much stuff going on.
Well,
you
there
just
is
can't keep that
stuff
up.
Going on. Well, I think one of the reasons that that Vic could do that is that he was a quiet man. Mm-hmm. Right? So he didn't actually feel the need to have his voice at the center of everything that went on in the state.
Much to Denny Miles' consternation.
Sure. Yeah, that's right. And it meant that, you know, when you're talking about the rug sales guy, the image that came to mind was the Lincoln White House. Mm-hmm. There were people wandering in and out of the Lincoln White House all the time, and they'd bump into Lincoln, and they'd ask him about something, and he'd say, go talk to somebody or something. But that quality of letting the government operate, setting it up, put the right people in the right places, trusting them to do their jobs, stepping in to keep it on course when it needed to be on course, and on a few major things, seizing the leadership and driving it right then. Mm-hmm. But not spending your whole day thinking that you were the center of everything and the be-all and end-all and it all had to flow through you.
Yeah. Right?
That's a personal quality.
Yeah.
And it was probably frustrating for some people who think that the governor can exercise a kind of leadership that forces things to happen. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the governor can, but you got to kind of pick your battles.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And you don't always know when you walk in which battles you really ought to be picking.
And he based his prioritization system on his principles.
Yeah.
He did it with why he would veto something. He did it on what policies he'd pursue.
Yeah.
Basically, he had a set of principles, and if it's up here, we've got to do it. If it's here, and down here, whatever everybody else decides is fine.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That gave him, in a way, more freedom of action from my perception.
Because,
you know, I've been down to the governor's office. I'm trying to think, his may have been the first governor's office I was ever in, so I've probably been in the governor's office for probably each of the subsequent governors at some point. I haven't been down to visit Kate yet, you know. But the sense of frenetic energy on the governor's office is very different with different governors.
Yeah. Right?
But the relaxed quality around Atiyah's it was notable. And so the kind of thing that you're talking about, that makes perfect sense to me. People would not have felt that they needed Atiyah's support or permission to do something that mattered unless it was an issue that was fundamental to him.
Right.
And that meant that it could just kind of work.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Excellent. So any last things? This is wonderful.
Hoping for.
Yeah. Just wonderful.
Good. Well, I look forward to seeing what you come up with.
Yeah. Well, so will I.
I do my best to the Atiyah family.
Oh, yeah.